welcome to PAL Cinema. I'm Dan Pal. This is the seventh in our series of podcasts on the subject of film. And today we're going to be reviewing the new Julie Taymor film, Across the Universe. And I have with me some that I think is pretty qualified to have a discussion on this. True, he has taken a couple of my film courses over the years. But more important than that, Frank Rowley is one of the vocalists and the bassist for the Stingrays, which is a band. Maybe you can mention a little bit about the band and what you do and why I would think that you'd be uniquely qualified for this.
Oh, uniquely qualified? Well, I even more than just the Stingrays, I think possibly my love of the Beatles would put me in there too, plus all things 50s and 60s.
Because the band is basically a 50s, 60s oriented band.
Right? Right. We try to recreate the music the best we can, and we try to just bring the whole atmosphere of the 50s and 60s back to the shows and try to stay true to that time period. Playing festivals, and that's our main fun, and off-season clubs, and just having as much fun with it as we can.
Yeah, well, and I know you do. I know you do. And it is a fun band. You guys have to check them out. Well, I will have their link on my palcinema.com website, so you can check out some of the dates that they have coming up. Let's start into the universe, or let's go across the universe with this film. And maybe we should say something about the plot first, because we both agreed that we didn't really know how much of a plot there was actually going to be in advance. But Frank, do you want to mention what you would see as is generally what this film is about?
Well, on one level, it's pretty much a coming-of-age movie. It's growing up, and it's a little bit of boy meets girl. There's a lot of tributes to other things in there. It seemed a little bit influenced by Hair.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a little bit of that in there. As far as the plot goes, it was not an overwhelming plot and not very hard to follow, but it wasn't simple-minded by any extent.
Yeah, the film takes place in the 1960s, and we basically follow these group of characters over the course of several years. We're not exactly sure which years it is, roughly about 65, 66 to maybe about 69. Is that what you got out of it?
That seems about right. The Cavern Club scene was probably a little sooner than that.
True.
It should have been maybe 63, 62.
Okay, that's true. So yeah, so they've jumbled some things a little bit.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Compressed for our enjoyment.
That's right. And, of course, the main feature to the whole film are the songs of the Beatles, which are sung throughout the film and serve as the basis, just to a certain extent, for the direction that the narrative takes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should start by talking just a little bit about how, overall, you think this idea worked. Did it work as a film to sort of link together all of these Beatles songs?
I thought it worked incredibly well.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it and thought that as far as the concept goes, I couldn't imagine it being done too much better. You have Beatles totaled maybe 215 songs or so in their entire career, and drawing from all those lyrics, you have a wealth of places to go with the plot.
Yeah.
And characters, you know, people, they drew from some of the songs that are about people that use names. Those characters kind of were true to the song.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, I thought as far as a movie using that device, I thought it was done incredibly well.
Yeah, and I agree. I thought it worked well, too.
Mm-hmm.
There's some problems with the film that I had, and we'll get into that. But I thought it was interesting that the choice of Beatles songs, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, was primarily the later Beatles as opposed to the early Beatles, which we heard one or a part of another song.
Yeah.
I Want to Hold Your Hand and a part of She Loves You, which is
yeah.
a part of All You Need Is Love anyway, but, mm-hmm. right?
And I think Hold Me Tight was in there.
Oh, Hold Me Tight.
There were a few. There were a few yeah. from the early days, but yeah, it was mostly the later songs, not even the middle period.
Yeah.
Quite a bit of later songs.
Which I think then, as I said, serves as the basis for the narrative, because you've got this lead character whose name is Jude, who meets Lucy, and of course we know that in time, Hey Jude and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds will be sung.
You hoped so, anyway.
And we also have a character named Prudence.
True.
Yeah,
and Max.
And Max, absolutely. So you can see kind of how the concept developed a bit. And as the film goes on, we have Lucy growing from a character that was obviously connected to somebody in high school, and he went off to war, and then she meets this guy from Liverpool who's Jude, and they strike up a friendship and something deeper than that, perhaps. And the film plays out as it follows them through the decade, and so we get, obviously, the Vietnam War, and we've got the assassination of Martin Luther King, and we get, you know, issues associated with the war and so forth. And I'm wondering, did you think that the narrative itself was strong enough? I mean, you know, you mentioned a little bit about the plot being not overly complicated, but did you think it was strong enough overall? Was it too thin? Did it feel like it was a full narrative that we were following?
Well, you know, providing that you're going to spend 2 minutes or so on a song, yeah, I thought the plot filled it out just fine, considering, what was it, a 2.5 hour movie or so?
Yeah, but yeah, about 2 hours and 10 minutes.
2:10? There was so much music in it that when the music wasn't being played, the music helped move things along too, obviously, but when it wasn't being played, I thought that the plot was interesting, and the characters' interactions were good, too, and held your interest.
I think there were a couple of times early in the film when I thought, okay, some of these songs are just here as a device,
oh,
or as
yeah.
part of the device, and we've got to put, with a little help from my friends in, so we're going to have this great scene of people getting high with their friends.
Right, right. Oh, there's quite a bit of that.
There were, actually. I mean, there's so many Beatles songs that are used in the film. I mean, as you say, it is primarily, you know, song after song with a little bit of dialogue in between, and we're sort of following these characters. I think on one level it could feel like there's a little bit of an emphasis on the cliches of the 1960s, because you do get the rebellious youth and the war and the anti-war demonstrations, and there's a lot of things that I thought were pretty predictable
mm-hmm.
about the film.
Yeah.
Did it bother you at all?
No, I didn't mind taking the trip, because I kind of knew where it would go.
Sure.
And I knew, you know, you kind of know when it's a boy meets girl, boy loses girl movie. You know where it's going to
yeah.
end, usually. And so it's just enjoying the ride
yeah.
more than being surprised at the destination.
Yeah.
Not like an M. Night Shyamalan.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I guess I thought in terms of an overall narrative, the way the screenplay was formed, there were a few things in there that seemed slightly out of place or slightly forced, like the Prudence character.
Mm-hmm.
She really was unnecessary to the entire film. And she has that one number, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Right.
And then she kind of disappears and she shows up, and she's not really developed as a character.
No.
And then all of a sudden, they're helping her, and so we get the... what's the name of the song? Hey Prudence? Or
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence. That just seems like, okay, it's there, but it really wasn't necessary.
And then they meet her again at the camp, or
right.
whatever that
oh,
was.
Oh, that's true.
The circus
yeah.
that they go to. She just shows up out of nowhere again.
Yeah.
But she did come in through the bathroom window to begin with.
This is true. So she just kind of shows
she,
up.
Yeah, she just shows up and she leaves.
I think, you know, when she's singing that, when she's singing I Want to Hold Your Hand, which I actually really liked, and I particularly liked the arrangement of that song.
Oh, I did too.
But it just didn't really it didn't connect to anything. Who is she singing about there? You know, she's sort of looking at this football team, and I'm not quite sure who we're supposed to be thinking that she wants to hold her hand. Why she needs to disappear from the whole thing?
Oh, that to me was one. That was the first real laugh of the film for me.
Is intentional or unintentional?
No, intentional. And I thought it was very deliberate on their part when she sings, "I want to be your man."
Right.
And she's looking at the other cheerleader.
Yeah.
I laughed at that moment. I thought I was the only person laughing in the theater. It wasn't a belly laugh, but I knew where it was going. And I thought she kept disappearing because there really wasn't a place for her.
Yeah.
Especially in Ohio.
Yeah.
In 1962.
So you thought it worked that she was always disappearing because it was reflective of the character.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I did.
I don't know that I would give the screen writer, which is Julie Taymor, was one of the screenwriters and the director. I don't know if I would give her that much credit, but I think that is a really good point.
Mm.
I think it's a really good point. The other one was Sadie and her connection to Martin Luther.
Yeah.
That was another that I thought was slightly...
Who was JoJo from Get Back? Get Back,
oh,
JoJo.
Oh, right, yeah.
Right. Which we never heard.
No, we didn't. We didn't. I just thought that, you know, those particular stories could have been developed a little bit more or just taken out of the film.
Yeah.
Because it is a little bit long at over 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
They could have been a little more secondary characters rather than characters that are partially developed and then kind of move into this. Kind of move into the background, and then they come back, and we're not quite sure exactly what the issue is with Martin Luther, and I don't think that's ever really clarified.
Well, there was one part where her new producer says to her, "The guitar is too laid back. We need a bet." So you kind of got the feeling she was leaving him behind and planning on doing the solo thing, and so that seemed to be the issue between those two.
Yeah.
But it did. It did lead to a couple good things.
Yeah.
You got to see JoJo and who's the main character? Jude.
Jude.
JoJo and Jude singing together on the street after a night out.
Right.
When they both lost their girlfriends. And so there were good moments that came from it, from that little tiff that those two had. And I'm not sure I would have wanted to have seen too much more of that.
Yeah.
Because they were really secondary characters.
Well, they were. And I guess my thought is, did we even need them at all? But you're right. They add a little bit in terms of, it allows for certain songs to be sung. And,
right.
And maybe we could talk a little bit about the actors and how well they perform the songs, because they do sing all of their own songs. What was your feeling about their vocals?
The vocals, one shocking thing about the vocals to me, and maybe shouldn't have been shocking, is they were all done in a real modern style, which modern vocals are real breathy.
Mm.
And none of the Beatles songs were ever done that way. And at times it worked really nice, and at other times you just wished that they'd sing it a little straighter.
Yeah.
And quit catering to the modern interpretation of everything where everyone sings in a breathy voice. So the main disappointment vocally for me was Sadie, who I thought could have been far more powerful. She was given Helter Skelter to sing, and I thought, I don't want to say, you know, I'm sure she did the best she could, but I could have imagined a more powerful voice behind that song.
Yeah.
And when you're going up against McCartney, who sang that song for the Beatles, and then you put a female voice, you'd imagine it could really scream and screech, and it didn't. And so there were some, and then Don't Let Me Down. I thought I was a little let down by her performance of that. Although it was nice, but didn't cut it for me. And Jude, I thought also, occasionally his breathy style worked real nice.
Yeah, yeah.
And his phrasing was real good, but occasionally it just didn't make it. It just didn't cut it either. But you're comparing him to the Beatles.
Yeah. There is definitely a contemporary feel to this film, and I don't know if it's intentional to link us with that era for the obvious reasons of making sure that there is an audience for the film, or linking us with that era in terms of theme and the whole idea of war. And, you know, there's all the protests and stop the war and so forth. And you can't help but hearing those protests in the film and seeing those scenes, thinking about the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought it was interesting that a lot of the characters, in terms of how they looked,
mm-hmm.
they really looked like they would fit in to society today, without yeah. question. I mean, the guys with their haircuts, very much in today.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, and even the female characters, too. You didn't necessarily feel like you were in a different era.
No. No, it wasn't faithful to the 60s in that way. It was very much a modern version of what we think of as the 60s.
Yeah. And I don't know if that was intentional. It wasn't like the Romeo and Julio, I'm thinking of Leonardo.
I know, right.
Romeo
right.
and Juliet with DiCaprio, where we have a total modern retelling of Romeo and Juliet, and everything is contemporary.
Right.
But it almost appeared that the attempt here was to make us feel like we're in the 60s, but did it really capture the feel for that era in terms of things like, I don't know, maybe clothes and attitude and sometimes expressions? Because I heard a few expressions that I think are a lot more contemporary. And I, one doesn't come to mind right now, but there were mm-hmm. a few expressions that I thought, okay, that sounds like something that people say now more than 40 yeah. years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was, it definitely was trying to appeal to, I think, the younger audience, the more contemporary audience now. And just capture the flavor of the 60s,
yeah.
which to a great extent is modern culture. We haven't come up with too much lately,
sure.
and most things do end up being look back, you know, look back at a previous golden era.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Beatles, there's really never been another Beatles as far as the fashion goes. You see a lot of it looking a lot like the 60s at this point.
Yeah.
And have for a very long time.
Sure.
And the 70s, too.
Sure.
So, retro
yeah.
sort of movie. And so, you know, I was able to live with because I didn't
yeah.
need it to have.
No,
To have, you know, oh, wait, that
yeah.
taxi cab was a modern taxi cab.
Right.
It didn't belong in that movie.
That's right.
I could live with that because I understood it was a taxi cab and just represented a cab.
Right. Absolutely.
That's
absolutely.
Right.
What did you think in terms of the arrangements of the songs? How'd they do?
A couple things bugged me. In general, nice. In
yeah.
general, nice. But there were several things that I would never have wanted to have seen. Talking during the songs, I think is sort of an MTV modern video
yeah.
thing. I thought was took me out of it for a few minutes when they were having conversations during a song.
That would break the song apart.
It broke
yeah.
the song apart and really just interrupted the whole thing.
Yeah.
The medley thing, I thought, was done quite well when they mixed several songs, especially the later. I think it was, I might be wrong.
No, it happened. I'm trying to remember which
yeah,
ones they were
I
myself.
Thought it was Revolution with Across the Universe, maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really not sure. But I thought those were done fairly well. It bothered me there was as much background noise during the songs, especially during Revolution.
Yeah.
When he walks in
yeah.
to the protest room and he's confronting his girlfriend, I thought they could have made a real nice use of more silent film technique
mm-hmm.
where you understood that Lucy was upset.
Right.
She didn't have to yell at him
right.
in between lyrics.
Good point.
Those sort of things bugged me. That was the main thing.
Yeah.
And the other thing, as far as arrangement goes, I really felt the vocals were so far up front in every musical arrangement that the music behind it was so discounted and so put in the background. And when you could hear it, it wasn't particularly done well either.
Hmm.
So it was a little too Hollywood band gets to play these songs, super slick arrangements, and lost a lot of the real energy that the
yeah.
songs originally had. And I thought they could have really done better.
Do you think that was done maybe to emphasize the lyrics
mm-hmm.
of the song? Kind of almost like a film being shot in black and white versus color, and you shoot it in black and white because you don't want all of the sort of noise to distract you from the color or from what is specifically being said in the screenplay. And I wonder if maybe that's where Taymor was going with that.
I think that's what they were thinking, but at the same time, when you're taking from the Beatles,
sure,
and certain signature guitar licks are just, they're as important as the vocal, and you downplay them and play them underneath everything so you barely hear them, I think you lose a lot of the magic of the song. And some of those things could have been brought out just a little bit more, I think, without interfering with anything.
So which song performance did you enjoy the most? And were there particular number? And it could be just in terms of the overall visual associated with the song, or just...
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thing. I Want to Hold Your Hand was a nice vocal, very subdued background music, and when I deliberately closed my eyes to avoid the choreography during that time, and it didn't work. It didn't work at all. It really needed the visual with it. And so much of this needed the visual to work, which it's a movie, which is great, which is why, you know, I think most people will view it. Unfortunately, the comparison's going to come, and they're going to say, well, okay, as a piece of art, it doesn't stand up to the Beatles songs.
Right.
And you had a chance to put a visual to it and a story behind it, and you would think with a gestalt, you could, it should be greater. Than the parts, but that's just definitely not what happens. And in this sort of device, it's everything gets watered down just a little bit to make the final product. Yeah, the vocals get watered down, the backgrounds get watered down, the plot has to serve the songs. So I think as a device, they did about as good of a job as they could, but because you're having to make all these things that don't fit together, it's amazing you come up with anything.
Absolutely.
And I thought they came up with some really nice stuff.
I think, you know, probably the two performances that I liked the most, and again, not necessarily vocally, but just visually what was done. One was the I Want You number.
Oh, yeah.
Never
thought of that as a march.
Yeah, the Max character is about to go off to war. And I thought it was really interesting because... It actually reminded me a lot of Metropolis. And I think that was, I'm guessing, intentional. Just there's another scene later in the film that reminded me a lot of the Odessa Stare scene in Battleship Potemkin. At the point during one of the protests when some of the characters are running down the stairs and you see the soldiers going down the stairs in that same sort of almost dehumanized fashion. And so there's that element of, you know, war dehumanizes people and the army dehumanizes people. And I liked the way some of those songs depicted that. The other one, I think, that was just really a lot of fun was the I Am a Walrus. Yeah. I Am the Walrus with Bono.
Yeah.
And the colors associated with it. That's a total visual feast.
Right. Oh, yeah. Cinematography was just incredible. The effects were incredible. And I thought just kept your interest. Even if the music was a little less than the original, adding the visual to it really just made it so much nicer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it stands on its own it can stand on its own as a movie without being judged as, well, the performances aren't as good as the Beatles. Well, this isn't as good as that.
Right.
You know, so
this is someone's interpretation of the era and Beatles songs, essentially. You know, there are some very, very inventive things in the film. Definitely the visuals, the set designs, the cinematography. You won't be disappointed. There's an element of it that reminds me of, music videos, but also something like Fantasia, where you can sort of look at it at an individual song and the way it's sort of put together, and they're all very different, but some of it is just absolutely beautiful and really, really interestingly choreographed.
Well, Let It Be being sung by a gospel choir, and that moment when you see the child in the casket, it's just super powerful image, and maybe it's not as good of a version of Let It Be as some Beatle fans would like, but when you put it with the image, it's an incredibly moving moment. And the Hey Jude part, when he sees Max in the mirror.
Yeah.
And Max is singing to him, giving him advice across the ocean. And he's leaving. Suddenly, his mother puts in another part.
Right.
And you realize the advice in Hey Jude and the song's lyrics are so much what a friend would say to
you. Sure.
And what a mother would say to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it works so well.
Yeah.
You know, that just so many clever things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that I think there's enough in the film that it sounds like we both would say it's a film worth seeing.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you like the Beatles. And and also, I think if you like films that just sort of do some different things.
If you like film. I saw references to Stardust Memories when he's on the bus. Well, Stardust Memories,
Of Stardust Memories,
eight and a half.
Absolutely.
Where he's on the bus and he sees himself in another bus.
Yeah, where he would rather be, perhaps.
Right. There's the rooftop concert, which is a reference to Let It Be.
Right.
There's the Magical Mystery Tour bus. There's a lot of stuff like that. I mean, they didn't just borrow Beatles songs.
Right.
They borrowed from other movies. And scene where they're all laying down on the ground with their heads together, right out of hair, done really well.
And, you know, some might say, again, those are all cliches. I don't know. I think it's another way of weaving this whole thing together.
Right.
And, you know, let's face it. I mean, how else would we get Beatles songs in a film, at least to this level? I mean, I suppose there's there's a variety of ways that we could possibly do that in our film industry today. But this is just one version, and I think it's a lot of fun, and it's fun to experience. Not saying that it's a totally it's not a comedy by any stretch.
No.
It's actually pretty dark, and because it does emphasize the later years and the heaviest point during America's occupation in Vietnam or towards that point, it actually is pretty heavy for most of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just such an interesting visual experience. I was never bored in one moment in the film.
No, neither was I. When you're using the trap they were in, you're using someone else's music. You're also trying to create something that's long gone. And so there's really, you're going to fall into cliches.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you string the cliches together
is where the
creativity comes
in.
And that's what impressed me.
Yeah.
So I was acceptant of cliches because I thought, well, this is all a reference to the past.
Right.
As it is. But it was a new way of stringing them together.
Sure.
That I thought was really entertaining.
I would agree. And on that note, what we decided to do for our top three this week is to review the top three films with the best use of rock music. Or maybe another way of saying that is the top three films using rock music, which kind of leaves it open to rock musicals or other films that just tend to use a lot of rock music. So, Frank, do you want to begin and reveal what your number three?
Oh, we're going backwards.
We are.
Okay.
Well, 'cause we have saved the best for last.
Oh, well, yeah, that just makes sense. It's like Miss America.
And so why don't you give your number three?
Yeah, my number three would be Apocalypse Now.
Okay.
And just the incredible use of cinematography and music at the same time. Just the opening sequence of that movie, which the movie doesn't start with credits or anything like that. Just the helicopter blades give you the beat.
Sure.
And then the Doors start playing the end. And just as the lyric comes in, you're watching a jungle, a beautiful jungle. You've been watching it for a minute. It explodes in flames.
Yeah.
As Jim Morrison sings, "This is the end."
Yeah.
And
incredible.
Another incredible moment in that movie was "I Can't Get No Satisfaction."
Right.
While they're on the boat skiing, you know, skiing, but water skiing.
Right.
And the wake of the boat is pushing the peasants on their little boats away.
Yeah.
And just how rudely everyone was being at that point. And Unfortunate Son was another great moment in that movie.
Yeah, it was a powerful link between visuals and music, without a doubt.
Yeah.
My number three is the film Magnolia, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, that began as a project where he wanted to set Amy Mann's music to film. In other words, he wanted to put together some sort of a narrative surrounding some of her songs and then have her create a couple of other songs. And it's, you know, it's a big sprawling epic sort of relationship film with a unusual little frog scene near the end, which I wouldn't, you know, reveal in all details because you have to see it in order for it to be believed. But what I think really worked about it is her songs they're very diverse and they're very personal, and this was a film about a lot of characters that were going through some really difficult stuff, and there's a point in the film when they all actually start singing the song Wise Up, and you see Tom Cruise sort of mouthing to it. You see Julianne Moore mouthing to it. And it's kind of hokey, but it actually really works. Hmm. It really works because the song really says a lot about where all these characters are at that point. And I think that Anderson put all the songs together so well that we're not feeling like, okay, this is just another device and we're going to string these songs. It actually, I think, really works. And a lot of the songs are in the background. I mean, that's the only song that they sing, but I think it works really well as a film. So that's my number three.
I haven't seen it. I'm going to have to rent that.
Check it out.
I will.
How about your number two?
Number two would be This is Spinal Tap.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Rob Reiner, I think Rob Reiner might have been influenced a little heavily by All You Need Is Cash or The Ruddles. Movie, which was an NBC movie,
okay,
with Eric Idle and the cast of Saturday Night Live. So right away, you've got a great combination.
Sure.
Monty Python and Saturday Night Live come together. Guest appearances by George Harrison and the like. I thought This is Spinal Tap. The Ruddles were a little English, kind of subdued humor. Mm-hmm. Even though it was Python, it was a little subdued. This is Spinal Tap just became so much more real.
Yeah, absolutely.
And being in a band, you can see elements of every gig you've ever played being played out in that movie, which it may be a little self-centered of a pick for number two, but if you've ever been in a band, you'll recognize at least 50% of the jokes that are in that movie.
And I think, you know, the film, obviously, so many people connect to it because it has lasted for, what has it been, 20-something years now since it was released, and people still love it. It's a hilarious film.
And the songs are hilarious.
Absolutely.
The songs are hilarious.
Well, my number two is the film Trainspotting.
Mm.
And what I love about the music in the film is it basically, this is characters that are pretty heavily filled with drugs throughout much of the film, and the music really takes us on their journey, and that the highs and the lows are perfectly sort of etched with the music. You've got the music from a couple of eras, because the film sort of takes us through time from some exuberant Blondie song like Atomic to other more darker songs, and just the use of, you know, Lou Reed and Iggy Pop and New Order. I just think it works really, really well. And every moment that the music is in the film really connects to what's going on with those characters. And I love the film, but I really like the music in it.
Mm.
How about you, number one?
Number one. Number one changed for me.
Really?
Yeah, changed for me just on the ride over here.
Wow.
And the number one I'm going to mention first,
okay,
didn't even make the top three. Just got knocked back to maybe
really?
Number four.
So you'd think it would be two.
You'd think so, but sometimes art is weird. It doesn't always work that way. It's not linear. So my number one is actually not the one I'm going to mention. American Graffiti was number one for me.
Right.
And I really enjoyed it, and I thought it captured, just like this, it captured an era, or at least an imaginary era that people have of the 50s, and the songs just supported the whole thing. But I decided, maybe that's number four for me, and what jumped ahead of it was actually A Hard Day's Night, which is just one of my all-time favorite films, and it's sort of a comedy version of neorealism. if that's possible.
And, yeah, that's kind of an oxymoron.
Yeah, it very much is, but leave it up to the English to come up with that. And I think set the stage for my number two film, for Spinal
sure.
Tap and for everything else. And there's subversive scenes in it, too. Things that you don't catch until years and years later. Like, you see one scene where John Lennon is trying to snort a Coke bottle. Which, I'm sure that was deliberate. There's a reason it was a Coca-Cola
sure.
bottle. But I'm sure no one caught on in 1964 when it came out.
Probably not.
No, but, it 100 years later, you can really get a chuckle out of it. Plus, the performance, the Beatles weren't actors.
Right.
But it just didn't, as in the neorealism, they really filmed well. They were entertaining to watch. And the songs are just the Beatles at their height mm-hmm. at that time. Just completely innocent, excited to be where they were at. And it was before Beatlemania drove them downwards. So just a really one of the happiest rock and roll movies I can imagine.
Cool. That's an excellent choice.
Thank you.
Well, my number one, you know, with rock and roll, after all, what is rock and roll? The rock and roll is a, I'm trying to say this intelligently to someone who, you know, makes his living with music. Rock and roll really does bring together a lot of music. And, you know, the R&B influences and so forth. So my number one is The Big Chill.
Oh.
And if you think of The Big Chill, there is such a wonderful collection of music from Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine to Procol Harum to The Rascals to Three Dog Night, CCR. And so there's rock, there's Motown. It's sort of this great sort of collection of music. Also, again, from the 60s to the early 70s, as we saw with Across the Universe. And, you know, the songs aren't there to necessarily move the plot along, but to really help the characters reconnect with each other. It's very nostalgic for them, and it's very nostalgic for people who lived through that era. And I think it was a great marketing tool on that film. The soundtrack was hugely successful. But, whenever I hear the song, You Can't Always Get What You Want, and it's being played at the funeral when one character has died and all the main characters are getting together for that funeral, I just think, man, I mean, to me, that it brought that song to life for me. And it really said a lot to me about what the song is about and the aging process, and I just think it really, really worked.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm giving it to The Big Chill.
Yeah. Well, incredibly successful soundtrack.
Absolutely.
Which, just back to Across the Universe for a second, I don't believe you'll see that from this film.
I don't know. Well, yeah. I thought about that. You know, as I was watching and thinking, which of these songs would I want to download?
Right.
And then I thought, well, maybe as videos,
mm-hmm.
they may be interesting. I'd like to see Bono doing that number again.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I don't know what the individual songs necessarily would be.
Interesting with the visual, but I don't think would stand up. I don't think most of them would stand up as a record. Close your eyes and the song becomes a lot less interesting. So I don't think we're going to see that. And I think if the music would have been performed a little straighter, I think you might have seen it. Because think of Beatles songs that have been covered.
Sure.
Now, Beatles are quite possibly one of the hardest bands ever to improve on.
Right.
I mean, you've really got... And they brought in Joe Cocker. So, I mean, there's a guy who had a hit with a Beatle tune.
Right. Bono.
You brought in Bono, but I'm thinking Joe Cocker, who already did
it
once.
Oh, okay, right.
With a little help from my friends. He already did it once. I don't think this version will do it.
Right.
And Elton John did Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
True.
Hugely popular in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful version of the song. So, I mean, when you stop and think, the Beatles recorded so many perfect songs. How come we've only heard maybe two alternate versions from other artists? Even though hundreds of people have done hundreds of versions of it, they never actually sell. because they're not as good as the original, or they don't say anything new that adds to
it.
And I'm not sure I heard any performance today that would qualify as an Elton John version of Lucy in the Sky.
I agree completely. And the voices were great for the most part, but none that particularly stood out as hey, this is a new definitive version.
Which unfortunately, I think that's going to put a damper on the movie for a lot of people, because I don't think people will watch it as a piece of art on its own. They'll always be, and that's the trap you fall into doing a movie like this, they'll always be judging it against what you took it from.
Sure.
So it's a little unfortunate that people have to do that, but I think the general public might just think that way.
Well, and on that note, that about wraps up our discussion on Across the Universe. I want to thank Frank Rowley for being a part of this today.
I would like to thank PAL Cinema for having me today.
Well, and PAL Cinema definitely thanks you. And I do want to remind listeners to check out my website. That's palcinema.com. And you can always email me if you would like to discuss anything that we've mentioned. And as I mentioned, there will be a link to Stingrays, the Stingrays website. So if you have any questions, definitely be in contact with me. Otherwise, we will talk to you again next week. Take care.